they want the COVID vaccine, and we don't have it.
As winter approaches, getting that COVID-19 vaccine is still tough because of delays by the CDC.
We will explain what is going on this Thursday, October 2nd, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. As the government shutdown continues, how are national park employees feeling about job security?
Also, on the eve of the WNBA Finals, controversy over the gender pay gap.
What people need to understand, we need great leadership in this time across all levels. This is straight up the most important moment in this league's history.
And the album that vaulted Bruce Springsteen to stardom turns 50.
It was all or nothing, because in the rest of my life at that time, I had nothing. Every night, that's how I went into the studio.
Those stories and more after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. It's day two of the government shutdown. Airport security still have to work but won't be paid. NPR's Joel Rose says that could impact travel with potential delays at airports.
For now, it looks like business as usual here at Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport.
This is a special security announcement.
But privately, several security officers told me morale is not good. Nationwide, more than 60,000 employees at the Transportation Security Administration, or TSA, remain on the job, though they won't be paid in full until the shutdown ends. During the last government shutdown, in 2018 and 2019, TSA officers began to call in sick in larger numbers as the shutdown wore on. Airlines are bracing for longer lines at security and other delays in the aviation system if the current shutdown continues. Joel Rose, NPR News, Arlington, Virginia.
An assailant drove a car into people outside a synagogue in northern England and then began stabbing them today, killing two and seriously wounding four on the holiest day of the Jewish year. Police said they killed the suspect in the assault. London police declared the rampage a terrorist attack. The White House is asking a handful of U.S. colleges to sign a deal that they will uphold administration priorities on topics ranging from diversity to ideological values in order to get preferential access to federal funds. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny reports.
The Trump administration sent a letter to multiple colleges requesting they commit to things like viewpoint diversity, free speech, and rooting out what the administration says is, quote, anti-Semitic and illegal behavior on college campuses. In response to the memo, the chairman of the University of Texas System Board of Regents said in a statement, the system was honored that its flagship campus was chosen, and quote, we welcome the new opportunity to working with the Trump administration on it. This latest attempt at a compact comes after the Trump administration canceled or threatened to cut federal funding for universities over a number of issues, including transgender policies, diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, and anti-Semitism. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News.
Trade officials in Taiwan say they will not agree with President Trump's proposal to move 50% of the country's chip manufacturing to the U.S. As Ashish Valentine explains, America's appetite for Taiwanese chips is often seen as a deterrent from a potential Chinese invasion.
From smartphones to automobiles, Taiwan produces the vast majority of the high-tech chips modern technologies need. Many Taiwanese believe the global dependence on Taiwan's semiconductor industry helps protect the island from a potential Chinese attack. Taiwan's chief negotiator, Zheng Lijun, emphasized she never promised Washington a 50-50 split and would not agree to any such terms in the future.
Ashish Valentine reporting. Wall Street closed up today as technology stocks keep rising and as investors keep ignoring the government shutdown. From Washington, this is NPR News. Israeli strikes and gunfire killed at least 57 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip today, as Hamas is still considering its response to President Trump's proposal to end Israel's nearly two-year war there. The plan requires Hamas to return all hostages and give up power. It sets no path to Palestinian statehood. The proposal has been accepted by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The Eiffel Tower is closed because of another day of labor strikes in France. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports the protests are aimed at France's new prime minister, who has not yet named a government.
Sébastien Lecornu is Macron's fourth prime minister in a little over a year. He, too, is from the president's center-right camp. The last two prime ministers were deposed in no-confidence votes. teachers, train drivers, and other public sector workers have walked off the job and into the streets to protest for the second time since the beginning of the school year. There are some 250 union-led marches across France. The head of France's largest and most left-wing union said Macron cannot continue governing against the will of the people. Protesters want a premier from the left who will raise taxes on the rich to plug the deficit. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell says the league plans to launch women's and men's professional flag football leagues in the coming years. He said the leagues will be created ahead of the 2028 Los Angeles Olympics, which will feature flag football for the first time. The NFL has prioritized flag football as a way to attract young fans amid concerns about concussions and player safety. I'm Ryland Barton. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. The History of Jazz airs Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4 with host Paul Kibbe, exploring the distinctly American art form. Hear more Jazz Sundays at 6 p.m. with volunteer-hosted Jazz on America Avenue. Weather tonight, slight chance of showers and thunderstorms, cloudy with temps near 58 degrees. Tomorrow, fog early and partly cloudy with highs 82 to 85.
Things Considered from NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Ilse Chang in Culver City, California. Well, getting an updated COVID-19 vaccine can still be tough, if not impossible, for a lot of people. That's because of an unusual delay by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in giving final guidelines for the shots. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein has been covering this and joins us now. Hi, Rob.
Hey there, Elsa.
Hey. Okay, so it's October, which means the winter respiratory viruses are just around the corner, but some people still can't get vaccinated against COVID. So what's going on here?
Yeah, you know, this year's rollout of the COVID vaccines has been really chaotic from the start. Many people have been able to get the shots, but for many others, it's been really hard, and that's still the case. I talked about this with Dr. Elias Cass. He treats kids in Seattle.
We have parents asking every day for vaccines. They want the COVID vaccine, and we don't have it. And we don't have an ETA. We don't have anything. We don't want kids to be sick. Like, we don't want them to suffer. We have the opportunity to prevent that suffering, and we as a society are blowing it.
Yeah, okay, so what's the problem exactly?
The problem is that the CDC has kind of ghosted the process. The agency hasn't put out final guidelines for the vaccines, even though the CDC got the recommendations from its advisors almost 2 weeks ago. That's very unusual. Typically, the CDC acts within days, sometimes hours, to get vaccination rolling. Hmm. Federal officials didn't respond to NPR's request to explain the delay, so it's a mystery.
It's a mystery. Okay, well, can you talk more about how this is affecting people?
Yeah, sure. The holdup means the Federal Vaccines for Children program can't ship any vaccines. And that's huge because 40% of the nation's kids get their shots free through the program. I talked about this with Remy Sweeney Garrett. She's one of the moms waiting for shots from Dr. Cass for her two daughters.
I'm very worried. And I'm worried about my youngest daughter in particular having to go to the hospital because she is susceptible to respiratory complications. And it's frustrating because I feel like this is within the control of the people in our government. And it's heartbreaking to see people making decisions that are going to harm a lot of people.
And you know, Elsa, it's not just kids who are struggling to get vaccinated. Adults in many places are still having to navigate the patchwork of state regulations. Some pharmacies still require a prescription. Others turn away people who can't document they're eligible. I talked about this with Dorit Rice. She studies vaccine policies at the University of California, San Francisco.
It's a mess, and it's an easily avoidable mess. They chose not to take action, and the result is a mess. I think it'll harm public health, and the result will be more COVID-19 and more harms from it.
Until the CDC acts, it'll still be confusing which pharmacists can administer the shots.
Okay, and can you just remind us, Rob, who is supposed to be eligible for these shots?
Yeah, well, that's the basic problem underlying all of this. Until this year, anyone 6 months or older could get a shot from their pharmacist. But the Food and Drug Administration only approved the new vaccines for people at risk for serious complications because of their age or health. Then the CDC advisors weighed in about the nuts and bolts of making them available. And after a tumultuous meeting, the advisors added one new hoop to getting vaccinated. They said people must consult with a health professional first. But as long as people do that, the recommendation would make more people eligible, overriding any specific risk requirements. But the CDC's silence since then just basically froze everything in limbo. And now the government's been shut down, and that's added even more uncertainty to the process.
So much frustration. That is NPR health correspondent Rob Stein. Thank you, Rob.
You bet, Elsa.
The National Park Service is one of the many federal agencies affected by the government shutdown. It is a high-profile government agency. It's one that many Americans interact with. Thousands of people visit parks, memorials, and other sites run by NPS every single day. That includes Independence Hall, the site of the signing of the Declaration of Independence in Philadelphia. WHYY's Carmen Russell-Suchansky visited the important national landmark.
In the heart of Philadelphia, dozens of people are waiting in line to see the Liberty Bell. But once they get to the front of the line, they have to view it through a window from the outside. Many out-of-town visitors plan their trips months in advance, but a government shutdown interfered with their plans. Liberty Bell Center is now closed, along with other NPS sites inside buildings. The Liberty Bell is one of several attractions that make up Philadelphia's Independence National Historical Park, which sees 3 million visitors each year. Like Jessica Breen, who was visiting with her family from Napa, California. She planned to visit the bell with her 84-year-old mother.
Today, she said, "We're going inside. I can't wait to see it. I've been waiting my whole life to see this, and today we weren't able to go inside. And unfortunately, there's probably no chance she'll be able to make this trip again." So,
Jonathan Mitchell, visiting from Dallas, says he's disappointed.
You come here to be able to have that in-person experience and somewhat feeling shortchanged, if you will. To be standing outside looking through a glass after traveling, you know, miles to be here.
For federal employees at Independence Park, the furloughs also come with fears about permanently losing their jobs. President Trump is threatening mass layoffs during the shutdown. Mark Cochran, president of the American Federation of Government Employees Local, which represents national park employees all around the Northeast region, added that if the shutdown is prolonged, it could threaten the city's plans for the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence.
It's crazy. And so, so what happens if in these rifts, the employees whose job it is to make sure that these anniversary events go off without a hitch, if they're not there anymore? I mean, I don't know. Your guess is as good as mine.
The National Park Service has not yet responded to a request for comment about those concerns. But Cochran says that employees are already reaching a breaking point.
It's been hard. You know, it's, I don't know. It's, you know, you keep giving and giving because you're dedicated to the mission of preserving our country's history for the next generation. But at some point, a person can only give so much before they can't give any more.
In a lawsuit filed Tuesday, the National AFGE sued the Trump administration to stop potential layoffs, saying they can't fire people during the shutdown. For NPR News, I'm Carmen Russell-Suchansky in Philadelphia.
The WNBA finals begin tomorrow night, but now there's a bigger conflict brewing in the league. Concerns simmering all season long boiled over this week when a star player held a press conference to criticize the league's commissioner. NPR's Becky Sullivan reports.
Nafisa Collier sat down at the microphone, her foot in a boot after an injury in her last game of the season.
Sorry, I had to walk here in my boot. I'm kind of out of breath.
Collier is a five-time WNBA All-Star, MVP runner-up 2 years straight. She's the vice president of the Players Union and overall one of the most respected players in the league. So her remarks Tuesday turned a lot of heads.
We have the best players in the world. We have the best fans in the world. But right now, we have the worst leadership in the world.
For four straight minutes, Collier blasted the WNBA's leadership, especially Commissioner Kathy Engelbert. In private conversations, Collier said Engelbert told her that star players with big fan bases like Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese should feel grateful for the platform that the WNBA gives them, even as their rookie contracts pay them only about $80,000 per year. And the commissioner dismissed her concerns about referees, Collier said, telling her that only losers complain about the refs.
Just hearing over and over and over again, we have the best refs in the world. We don't have a problem. You know, none of the injuries are due to physicality in the way that we're reffing. It's an insult to my intelligence, honestly.
The reason Collier gave this statement wearing a walker boot is because she just hurt her ankle during the playoff series between the Minnesota Lynx, her team, and the Phoenix Mercury.
Collier gets it back, but Alyssa Thomas picks her pocket.
Game three had been physical and tough all game long. With just 24 seconds to go and the score close, a Mercury player stole the ball in a collision with Collier, who fell to the ground and immediately began slapping the floor in pain. There was no foul call.
And he still on the floor.
Collier had to be helped to the locker room. Reportedly, she tore a few ligaments in her ankle. Afterward, her coach Cheryl Reeve let it fly.
When you let the physicality happen, people get hurt. There's fights.
Speaking with a frustration that seems to have built up over the course of the whole season, Reeve excoriated the referees for allowing so much contact that ultimately she felt the gameplay had become dangerously physical and aggressive.
And so if this is what our league wants, okay. But I want to call for a change of leadership at the league level when it comes to officiating. It's bad for the game.
These critical words about league leadership come as the WNBA is maybe the biggest success story in all of sports right now. There has been a big boom in attendance and ratings over the past two seasons. New broadcasting deals are bringing in record revenue. Team values are at an all-time high, and the league is expanding, adding new teams. As commissioner, Engelbert has overseen all of that. But these questions about referees and physicality and injuries have been brewing for months, even years. It came up at a press conference with her back in July.
We hear the concerns. We take that input. Every play is reviewed. We spend hours and hours and hours. Obviously, we use that then to follow up with officials, training.
NPR reached out to the WNBA for comment on this story. The league referred us to the brief statement that Engelbert put out on Tuesday, in which she said she was disheartened by Collier's remarks, but that she had utmost respect for WNBA players and an unwavering commitment to the future of them and the league. That future, players argue, can only exist when they are healthy. The superstar Caitlin Clark helped drive that explosion of interest in the WNBA last year. This season, injuries caused her to miss 70% of the Indiana Fever's regular season games and her team's entire playoff run. At a press conference today, Clark said she thought Collier's points were valid.
You know, I think what people need to understand, you know, we need great leadership in this time across all levels. This is straight up the most important moment in this league's history. Well, this league's been around for 25 plus years, and this is a moment we have to capitalize on.
There is a risk that the WNBA's historic momentum could come to a screeching halt. The players' union contract is set to expire at the end of this month. With the league bringing in more revenue than ever, the players want more money. Collier and Engelbert will be sitting across from each other at the negotiating table. If the two sides can't reach an agreement by next spring, the league could face a lockout. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:18, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Coming up next is your daily dose of phenology. Programming is supported by Empty Bowls, fighting local hunger and building a stronger community with the Grand Rapids and Deer River Community Cafe. The event takes place Thursday, October 23rd at Timberlake Lodge from 11 to 2 and 4 to 7. Tickets include soup and a locally made ceramic bowl. More info on Facebook at Itasca Empty Bowls Project.
On today's date, October 2nd, 2004, I wrote the following note. The asparagus looks like Christmas trees today as the foliage is green and the berries are orange-red. This is a really excellent time of year to stake out your asparagus patch. They grow in ditches and sometimes in open fields and sometimes tucked up against old homesteads, but here and there they survive. And this is an excellent time of year to look for them because they are, as I said, green with red berries. And this time of year, they're going to become progressively more and more yellow. And in fact, they will begin to look almost like flames on the countryside before the end of October. So check them out. And when you find them, if your memory's really good, you can probably just remember to come back there in the spring and harvest the stalks. But if your memory's more like mine, probably the best thing you could do would be to take some sort of little stakes out there and mark the area so you can find them again.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV, with new original series like Code of Silence about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation, streaming at BritBox.com. From Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where white sand beaches meet the arts, from the Dalí Museum to more than 500 public murals, more at VisitSPC.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Born to Run, the album that made Bruce Springsteen into the star we know today as The Boss, it turns 50 this year. To celebrate that milestone, the Bruce Springsteen Archives and Center for American Music in New Jersey held 6 days of events. NPR's Frank Langfitt decided to go recently and got a surprise. Hey, Frank.
Hey, Scott.
So, sounds like a very interesting assignment. It sounds like an interesting event to go to. You have a lot of things to cover right now. What made you think this is worth going to?
I wanted to do something that would also just be fun for our audience. And the reason I really wanted to go was there were a bunch of academics who were going to be talking about the album and analyzing it. But then I noticed that there was an entire day devoted to the creation of Born to Run, but they wouldn't say who was going to speak. So I had my suspicions. And I just jumped in my car and I drove 4 hours towards the Jersey Shore.
So you're like a Bruce Springsteen character. You're on the open highway yourself with hopes in your heart headed north. What did you find when you got there?
So I show up and there's this line out the door to the theater at Monmouth University. This is the home of the archives. And everybody in the audience is told they have to put their cell phones in locked bag. And inside on stage, I'm looking up there and I can make out their instruments under tarps. And then Springsteen himself comes on with the E Street Band, along with the producers and the studio engineer. Now, there's this guy, Bob Santelli. He runs the archives. He told me this is the first time everybody who had created Born to Run had talked about it together on the same stage. And, Scott, it was a little like a time machine. I remember the bulk of this album was recorded in 1975.
Yeah.
Back then, Springsteen is just a regional artist. He's not known beyond the East Coast. He put out two earlier albums. They had not sold. And Springsteen told the audience he felt like Born to Run was kind of like a last chance.
I was a serious young man, and it was all or nothing, because in the rest of my life at that time, I had nothing. Every night, that's how I went into the studio.
Now you know the album. Mm-hmm. The songs kind of blended this cars and girls teenage spirit from the Beach Boys with, you know, at the time was a much darker mood following Vietnam here in the country.
The screen door slams, Mary's dress waves, like a vision she dances across the...
Helping to pull this whole thing together was this 23-year-old studio engineer from Brooklyn.
Jimmy Iovine!
Now, Iovine explains how Springsteen, he's an infamous perfectionist, kept pushing everyone.
None of you have had the pleasure or the dread of this guy standing behind you for that many hours saying, no, no, no. I never met a person before or after that I can say the same word over and over and over and over and over. Two words, no and again.
I mean, Frank, that doesn't sound in the moment too pleasant.
No. I mean, there's unanimity that these sessions were long and tedious. Here's how Gary Talent, he's the bassist, described it.
Gary, do you have any memories of us cutting those tracks in the studio at the time?
I just remember it taking forever.
Now, Talent said he brought his wife to the studio once.
And she heard the same 8 bars over and over again for about 4 hours. She never asked to see another session.
Now, producer and manager John Landau, he said the sessions went so long, people would just nod off.
Jimmy, he would be sitting in the engineer's chair, and his eyes would glaze over, and he'd fall asleep, and I would get to say, Bruce, the engineer's asleep. I think it's time to go. You know, come on.
Now, Iveen, you know, he went on to become a record mogul. He said everybody there in the studio was just trying to divine the sound that Springsteen wanted.
What was going on was like The Wizard of Oz. It was like in black and white, and what his head was color. And everybody just did everything they possibly could to make it color.
And even Springsteen said he was kind of mystified by the process.
Our demos that we would go home with, you know, always sounded a little flat because of the nature of the studio. But when we went to mix it, is when everything really, the reverbs, the echoes, the size of the thing, all came alive. How did you do that?
I had never mixed the record before on my own.
Amazing.
So the first thing you do is method act. It's called I Look Like I Know What I'm Doing.
And I had a feeling that Jimmy simply twisted the dials until it sounded the way that I heard it.
Scott, this is another thing that was really interesting, is that Springsteen himself had listened to Born to Run so many times, he could no longer hear some of the notes as they actually sounded. Guitar Steve Van Zandt, he explained, he picked up a guitar and he played the opening riff to the song as Springsteen had actually recorded it.
He's doing like... Right?
So you can hear that kind of Roy Orbison twang.
The country western.
Right. That's not what Springsteen thought he'd played or what he wanted. Springsteen thought it sounded like this. And when he realized how it really sounded, he kind of freaked out.
That's all I can hear now. Da-da-da-da.
And that's how I say Bruce Springsteen's career.
Now, after Born to Run was released, it peaked at number 3 on the Billboard album chart. A couple weeks later, Springsteen ends up on the covers of Time and Newsweek. Recording the album, as you can hear, was an ordeal. But Springsteen says it never would have become a rock classic without the people who were on that stage.
You know, when you had nothing and were no one, these are the guys that gave you everything. So I thank all of you.
I love this moment of creation where something could go either way, and
yes,
they're making tweaks, and the end result is something that when they play 50 years later, entire football stadiums go nuts for. You know, these songs have such a lasting impact for so many people. But it could have been a different song. It might not have worked. And there's a lot to think about there. And I'm just wondering what the audience was like to hear these stories up close. He's such a faraway figure now, to hear them recreate this moment of 50 years earlier.
Here's what I understand, and this is when I've ever looked at a creative process, as all of us. When you get inside it, you realize that it's incredibly collective. Mm-hmm. None of it is inevitable. And things could have gone very differently, and we would not be sitting here talking about this guy. And that really is what comes across listening to several hours. I mean, they're as surprised as we are that this worked out.
Why do you think he did this event?
He's building his legacy, Scott. Springsteen has been talking about his music a lot in the last decade. You know, he had that one-man show on Broadway. There's a new book out on the making of Born to Run. And in a few weeks, a biopic is coming out, Deliver Me from Nowhere. And this event, the first time, again, all these guys had been on stage talking about that, this is a part of the oral history for the archives. And it may not happen again. Springsteen just turned 76.
NPR's Frank Langfitt, thank you for bringing up this story. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Scott. Happy to do it.
This is NPR News.
We'll keep you up to date on the government shutdown and speak with lawmakers and federal workers at the center of the story. Also, how the Constitution has been amended and reinterpreted throughout history.
There are very difficult constitutional battles ahead, but there's a lot to be learned from the way those battles were waged in the past.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. Support for KAXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. The Friends of the Brainerd Public Library have their big fall book sale now through Friday, October 3rd at Westgate Mall from 10 to 6 each day. United Way of Bemidji is collecting coats and other winter gear now until October 7th at Dress Club Cleaners in both Lukens Village Foods locations. Items may be new or gently used. Distribution will take place Saturday, October 11th from 9 to noon at First Lutheran Church in Bemidji. Now it's time for National Native News here on KAXE KBXE.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The president of the Oglala Sioux Tribe has denounced the decision by Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth not to revoke medals awarded for one of history's most infamous massacres. Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire has more.
In late December 1890, members of the 7th Cavalry attempted to disarm a large group of Chief Spotted Elk's followers they had encircled at Wounded Knee Creek, South Dakota. A shot went off, and the soldiers mowed down the group of largely Native women, children, and elders with rifles and powerful Hotchkiss guns. 25 soldiers were killed by friendly fire as well. Later investigations showed fleeing survivors were chased down and killed where they stood. The following year, 20 U.S. soldiers received the Medal of Honor for gallantry at Wounded Knee, but top brass, including Major General Nelson A. Miles, condemned the incident as, quote, the most abominable military blunder and a horrible massacre of women and children. Efforts to revoke the medals gained momentum starting in 1990, the centennial of the incident. But in a video posted to his X account last week, Secretary Hegseth said the 20 soldiers who fired upon the Lakota natives will not have their medals revoked.
We're making it clear that they deserve those medals. This decision is now final, and their place in our nation's history is no longer up for debate.
We'll continue to fight to get these medals rescinded.
Oglala Sioux Tribal President Frank Starr comes out as a descendant of Spotted Elk and a Marine veteran of the Gulf War and Mogadishu. He says he's not surprised by Hegseth's decision, but it still speaks to the indifference of those who don't know their history.
It's despicable, it's untruthful, and insulting to our people.
In a press release, the Oglala Sioux Tribe says descendants of those scarred by Wounded Knee have served honorably in every U.S. conflict from World War I to Afghanistan. And every year, an annual memorial ride is held to honor those killed at Wounded Knee. Again, Frank Starr comes out.
This is history. This is something that our people are traumatized with, and we have to live with that. And I keep saying this every time I go to Washington to advocate, not only for the Oglala Sioux Tribe, and tribes nationwide. You know, we were never dealt a fair hand.
Meanwhile, the National Congress of American Indians has also denounced Hegseth's decision and are calling on the U.S. Congress to pass what's called the Remove the Stain Act so that, quote, the nation's highest honor fulfills its namesake by reflecting courage, not cowardice and cruelty. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
The Belfast City Council in Ireland approved a historic policy for the island's indigenous language, as Sean McPullen reports.
Belfast City Councillors approved the new Irish language policy this week. It comes after years of advocacy and consultations with the indigenous language community. The city plans to redesign its logo to now include the original Irish spelling of Bailfirstia, which means mouth of the sandbank ford. The policy also pledges to ensure all city signs contain both languages. Far-right councillors tried to block the new policy, but were unsuccessful. The council previously earmarked the equivalent of $2.5 million to fund the changes, as well as new initiatives that remove barriers for the use of Irish in public life. The Irish language has been experiencing a renaissance of late, particularly among young speakers, in part thanks to the worldwide success of the Belfast band Kneecap. For National Native News, I'm Sean McPullen in Ireland.
The Cherokee Nation partnered with DreamWorks Animation and NBC Universal to dub the animated film How to Train Your Dragon in the Cherokee language. The Oklahoma tribe held a private screening of the film this week, which is streaming on Peacock. It's part of the tribe's Cherokee language preservation efforts. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. More at aarp.org.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. Surveys show that Americans took fewer and shorter trips this summer, mostly to save money. So for our cost of living series, we want to offer some tips for traveling on a budget. Travel writer Amelia Edelman gathered some guidance for NPR's Life Kit podcast. She spoke to fellow travel writer Brittany Oliver and financial advisor Nishan Lananta, who recommends starting to save for trips at least 6 months out if you can.
I often work with folks to set up a dedicated travel fund and contribute to it consistently, even if it's a small amount each month. So it can be a revolving travel fund. Say you know you're going to take 5 trips every year, or you know you spend at least $6,000 every year. Well, we know if we're spending $6,000 every year, we probably need to save at least $500 a month.
Even before you save, you've got to know your numbers. Sit down and track your spending over the next few months. Where can you cut back? Maybe you stop eating out so much, or you cancel that subscription service you don't use anymore. These small changes add up. But it's not just about saving enough for your trip. Nishan says you should also build in a financial cushion for any emergencies, whether that's unexpected medical expenses or an extra night at a hotel after a canceled flight.
When you plan for the unexpected, you have the ability to kind of take the pressure off of yourself. So the most obvious approach for managing those unexpected costs or emergencies is to build up a contingency fund, and that's usually around like maybe 10 to 20% of your total.
There are also travel grants available from nonprofits that you can use to augment your savings. WorldStrides and Travel Niche offer grants for families, and Wish of a Lifetime offers them for folks who are 65 and older in the U.S., for example. As for accommodations, where you stay can eat up a lot of your budget. So where are you going to stay? Be creative and flexible with where you stay and when you go. A little outside-the-box thinking will save you serious travel cash. Flexibility is everything when it comes to flight booking. First off, use flight comparison tools. They allow you to track prices over time, so you can look for deals and book when prices dip. Also, avoid flying on Sundays and Mondays, which tend to be the most expensive due to weekend trips and business travelers. Meanwhile, plenty of discount hotels are cheap and clean and even have some amenities that might save you money elsewhere. And while you may think of hostels as crowded spots filled with college-age backpackers, a little creative research will help you find the ones that are anything but. One thing you should never compromise on to save a few bucks, your own safety and peace of mind. Here's Brittany.
For me, like the hostel, I don't think I'll ever do that. Just for me, because I wouldn't feel safe.
Brittany also takes care not just with accommodations, but where she decides to travel.
That is so important because as a Black woman, there's a lot of places that haven't really seen a lot of Black people. we're just rare, unique when we go in those spaces. And that can cause safety risks. A lot of places also have biases, right? That poses safety risk.
Brittany does a lot of solo travel and relies on the usually cost-free online travel communities and affinity groups where she can connect with other travelers of color. Groups like this also exist for LGBTQ travelers, disabled travelers, and more. Another great approach Brittany recommends to finding free accommodations is actually taking friends and family up on offers of, hey, come visit anytime. The guest room is open.
A lot of us have, you know, friends who take jobs abroad or just happen to move abroad. And when they're like, come visit, do it. If you're comfortable staying at their house, using the couch, using their spare bedroom, and being able to travel and do the things that you want to do.
And once you're there, getting creative and not being married to the major sites and Michelin star restaurants can help you save on food, activities, and more.
Travel writer Amelia Edelman reporting for NPR's Life Kit podcast. For more stories from our Cost of Living series, go to npr.org.
Okay, so yesterday, the Italian art police in Parma captured 21 pieces of art. Art that is suspected of being Salvador Dali forgeries. This is not the first time that works by the 20th century Spanish surrealist have been called into question. It turns out Dali is among the most commonly forged artists. We're joined now by Colette Lal, a longtime art fraud investigator. Welcome.
Thank you. So nice to be here.
So nice to have you. Okay, so just curious, what was your reaction when you first heard about this seizure yesterday?
Well, it wasn't a surprise, I'll be honest, because this is pretty common. We see it in the field quite a bit in the art market, but also this is, I think, the third major seizure that the Carabinieri has done just with Salvador Dali works.
And the Carabinieri is like the Italian art police division?
Yes, it is kind of the famous art police squad based in Rome, and they're pretty much well known across the globe as being the most sophisticated investigators for art crime.
Wow. What are some of the methods that these experts use to identify forgeries?
Typically, art authentication has always followed what we call like the three-legged stool. There's three legs of authentication. There's the stylistic analysis, which is really subjective. There's provenance, which is the history of ownership and can also include an exhibition history. Most importantly is a scientific analysis. And that's the most important now because science doesn't lie.
Why is Dali's work forged so often? I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So what a lot of people don't know about Salvador Dali is that in the 1970s and 80s, he was reportedly signing thousands of blank sheets of paper for publishers to use in later limited edition prints. And so many of these sheets were either misused or taken advantage of. Some may have been signed under questionable circumstances when his health was declining. But the flood of genuine signatures on dubious works created this really fertile ground for forgery. Also, there was a huge global demand. I mean, his surreal imagery is widely recognizable and appeals to a broad audience. And then also the print market is very vulnerable. So unlike unique oil paintings, prints exist in multiples. And so provenance standards are often much looser.
Okay. Well, just to go back to the Carabinieri, this Italian art police force, I'm just wondering, I mean, they're so fierce. They obviously are quite busy. Is there really that much art crime in Italy that the police have this whole separate art crime division?
Yeah, they're quite renowned. They were founded in 1969, and they were the first police unit in the world that was dedicated specifically to combating art crime. And so Italy has more UNESCO World Heritage Sites than any other country and an enormous share of the world's cultural treasure. So that made it a prime target for looting and smuggling, and so hence the need for a specialized force. But the Carabinieri is not the only international art crime police that we see. There's also the FBI right here has a dedicated art crime squad.
Oh.
And also the Scotland Yard has an art and antiquities unit. So there are many other divisions of international law enforcement that specialize in cultural heritage crime.
That is Colette Lal, a longtime art fraud investigator. Thank you so much for joining us today, Colette.
You are welcome. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrea DeZingel. Coming up next is North Star Stories. Donating stocks and mutual funds is a quick, easy way to defend KAXE from funding cuts. You may receive tax benefits as well. Call Sarah for details at 218-326-1234. The McCroskey Arts Center in Grand Rapids hosts an opening reception for the new exhibit, Unearthed, tomorrow from 4 to 7. It's a two-person mixed-media show developed from foraged objects. And support for KAXE comes from the Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, featuring Martini Monday each week from 5 to 8 p.m., offering guests martinis and menu items such as chicken Kiev, a Reuben, or fettuccine Alfredo. The dinner menu and additional information are available at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. Now it's time for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
In today's broadcast, early voting is underway in Minnesota. Then, local officials warn about an invasive species in the Northeast waters, and a new state task force will try to make healthcare more affordable. I'm Gracie J. Minnesota voters can begin casting ballots ahead of Election Day on November 4th. Early voting runs through Monday, November 3rd. You can vote early in person by submitting an absentee ballot at your county election office or, in some cases, at your city clerk's office. Voters in areas where ballots are sent to voters by mail may also cast ballots early at their county office. Unless you are registering in person on Election Day, you have to register by October 14th. More information, including polling locations, is available on the Secretary of State's website. Next, in this month's report from the northeast part of the state, the WTIP News talks about an invasive species present in Cook County Lakes and a special visit from a group of international journalists to the WTIP station. Victor Palomino has more.
The spiny water flea is an invasive species introduced to Lake Superior in 1995. According to Kelly Hutkins, WTIP News reporter, in Cook County, about a dozen lakes have the spiny water flea.
Kind of a really small crustacean, and it was suspected to have been made or introduced to the Great Lakes through the use of ballast tanks on freighter ships. Since then, since it was introduced to Lake Superior, it's kind of expanded out regionally from there into many inland lakes, many of those in our neck of the woods in Cook County.
The spiny water flea eats the natural zooplankton in the northern Minnesota lakes called Daphnia, an essential source of food for native fish species. This creates a significant environmental impact.
The most recent story that we covered was that it was found in Poplar Lake just at the beginning parts of September. And so the U.S. Forest Service officials were doing some water testing and happened to find spiny water flea in Poplar Lake, which is a Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness Access Lake, very popular recreational lake. A lot of homeowners and property owners live on that lake as well.
The spiny water flea is most commonly spread through fishing lines, and it can also stick to the bottom of a boat or the bottom of a canoe.
So it attaches onto that really thin monofilament of that fishing line. And so if somebody is fishing one lake, moves over to a different lake and fishes, and then that spiny water flea is still hanging on, dangling on there, it can be introduced to a different lake. So the U.S. Forest Service and local officials recommend, if you're fishing, for any of those anglers to just wipe down your fishing line before you transfer over to a different lake and fish another lake.
In other news from the Northeast, a group of international journalist students recently visited the WTIP studios.
We had some 9 journalists from different countries visit us here at WTIP Community Radio in Grand Marais. And it's an annual fellowship program where nine or 10 journalists are selected each year. And it's been ongoing for, I want to say, about 40 years now. So they travel across the U.S. We're one of the stops here.
The group met with reporters and journalists at WTIP, and they also host a panel with community members in the area.
They'll visit the Cook County Historical Society, the Grand Portage National Monument, and a variety of other places. But it's an opportunity to learn about and explore kind of the United States media, culture, its politics, its current issues, how that relates back to, you know, their similarities potentially in their countries.
Some of the journalists shared their perspective with WTIP, and the interviews can be found at the station website. And the students?
They have absolutely loved Grand Marais so far. I mean, who wouldn't? We live in a beautiful place.
To listen to all of the stories from the Northeast, visit WTIP.org. For North Star Stories, I'm Victor Palomino.
You are listening to North Star Stories. The Minnesota Department of Health is launching its first healthcare affordability advisory task force. The 15-member group will study why healthcare costs continue to rise faster than wages and recommend strategies to keep care affordable for families, workers, and businesses. Department officials say the task force brings together consumer voices, healthcare experts, and community leaders from across the state. Members will review Minnesota data, national research, and patient experiences to identify bold, evidence-based policy solutions. The task force will hold its first meeting this month, and all meetings are open to the public.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. The federal government is closed for a second day. With park visitor centers locked and many federal employees furloughed, Republicans and Democrats say voters should hold the other side responsible for the fallout. But as NPR's Sam Gringless reports from Georgia, some people are focused less on who is to blame than on how long the shutdown will last.
The last shutdown dragged on for 35 days. Among the hardest hit were TSA employees at Atlanta's humongous airport who had to keep working without pay.
So we did mass distributions of food, and there were hundreds of cars in line of people who needed help.
Atlanta Community Food Bank President Kyle Wade says it's not clear if his organization will be looking at a small uptick or something more catastrophic.
Nonetheless, there will be more demand that food banks will have to respond to, on top of that extraordinary level of need that they're already facing.
At the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which employs thousands in Metro Atlanta, the shutdown also comes at an already taxing time. The Trump administration has spent months slashing CDC jobs and programs. Now thousands more employees are furloughed, and President Trump has threatened mass layoffs during the shutdown.
It feels like there's malice versus what it was like back in 2018, 2019.
Yolanda Jacobs is president of the union that represents many CDC employees.
Now we feel like whatever is happening is meant to intentionally clear out and cull the herd, so to speak.
At the 7,000-acre Chattahoochee River National Recreation Area, Conservancy Director Brittany Jones is also worried about the long-term consequences of a shutdown.
I had C-SPAN on, and it was a long, sleepless night.
The morning after funding lapsed, I met Jones by some Adirondack chairs overlooking the river. Park rangers rushed to close up the 1920s visitor center. Jones just had to cancel fourth grade field trips scheduled this week.
We're anticipating we're going to have to, unfortunately, disappoint all those kids that were excited to come to their national park right now.
Only 5 Park Service employees will remain on duty. Jones says she's proud the Conservancy can step up.
But we also don't want to set a precedent for stepping in too deep. Then there's an assumption that we can take on more roles, when the reality is our mission is to enhance the park, not run the park.
Jones is worried the shutdown could permanently reshape the relationship. Mary Kesey comes to this park often.
On a warm day, you'll see the cormorants with their wings out like that, and I think that'll be so great to see. So
she says she's not sure who's responsible for the shutdown.
I just heard something from one of the walkers. Is it the Democrats want to give free health insurance? And I wasn't sure to who.
She's referring to Democrats holding out for a deal to extend health insurance subsidies under the Affordable Care Act. Republicans have made misleading claims about undocumented immigrants getting them. At a trailhead, I found Stephen and Amantha Moore unloading a cooler from their rental car.
My retirement goal is to visit every park managed by the Park Service. So this is day 2 of a trip. It appears like it's not going to go as planned.
As they unfurled a big map of their itinerary, I asked the Moores how they saw the shutdown.
I respect the Democrats for taking a stand, finally.
Is there a limit to how long you think Democrats should hold the line?
I don't know how long. I mean, it could go on for months.
One of our sons worked for the National Park Service during that long period when the government shut down. And there were people in dire straits.
So how do you kind of square those two things together?
Well, I can't really.
This purple stretch of Atlanta suburbs will be a key battleground in next year's midterms when Democratic Senator John Ossoff is up for re-election. He voted against the Republican stopgap bill. Finishing lunch in a nearby town, Reg Hunter says he blames Democrats for the shutdown.
Now, Ossoff himself, I've heard him talk, and he seems like a fairly reasonable guy.
Hunter's lunch companion, Thomas Nelson, says he's not sure if the shutdown will affect his vote.
Maybe depending on how people act, you know, and how it gets resolved. I don't really spend a whole lot of time worrying about it. I think more about my kids and grandkids.
Though for many people, that could change the longer the shutdown wears on. Sam Greenglass, NPR News, Sandy Springs, Georgia.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain Podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. And today's story comes from Tanya Eby. When Eby was in sixth grade, her core group of friends suddenly told her that she could not hang out with them anymore. Eby obviously was stunned and devastated, and a few days later, she broke down crying in class. Her teacher, Mrs. Welch, pulled her into the teacher's lounge to find out what was wrong.
And I told her about the girls, but then I told her the rest of the story. And the rest of the story was, a few months prior to this happening, my mom and my stepdad decided my big brother, my anchor in life, needed to go live with my dad. So overnight, they took him and they dropped him off with my dad. So I woke up one morning and my brother was gone. So this was the background of what had happened when the girls told me that I was no longer part of their group. It felt like everywhere I turned, people I loved disappeared and they stopped loving me and they didn't tell me why and I had no control over it. So I was crying. And the teacher listened to my story. And in a moment that I'll remember forever, she just said, "Oh, honey." And she pulled me close to her. And she hugged me. That's it. She hugged me. And she let me cry. And somehow, her hug centered me. It rooted me. And it made me feel that I would be okay. I would figure it out. School ended. I never saw Mrs. Welch again. But that one act of deep caring and deep seeing influenced my whole life. It taught me about truly listening to someone's story. And even if you don't understand the reason for their pain, or maybe it seems superficial, like girls breaking up with you, there are sometimes deeper things happening that you don't understand. And just simply being seen, being listened to, is enough. Looking back, I just wanted to thank Mrs. Welch, wherever you are, for a moment of humanity and kindness, and for a moment of literally reaching out and helping me to hold on.
Tanya Eby lives in Dowling, Michigan. You can hear more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at viking.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the University of Maryland Libraries, dedicated to making UMD's research available to everyone and advancing open access for the public good. More at lib.umd.edu. This is NPR.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, A9.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. Watermark Art Center in Bemidji welcomes textile artist Kristen Anderson tomorrow from 5 to 7. Anderson's exhibit is Refugia, the Seasonal Pond Project, with tapestries accompanied by words from two local poets. Anderson will give a brief presentation at 5:30. Weather tonight, slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Cloudy with temps near 58 degrees. Tomorrow, fog early and partly cloudy with highs 82 to 85. Evening lows in the mid to upper 60s.
I think it's important for us to really work in a bipartisan